Sunday the 23rd of November, Kofheimal Cheshvan, by Dr. David Gottlieb, Anti-Semitism.
Anti-Semitism is a vast subject. I don't pretend in a half hour to do it complete justice, but it's a subject of extreme importance. And if I can offer perhaps a couple of thoughts that may provide broader perspective, then I would be happy to have made a contribution. When Haman's decree is publicized, Mordechai learns of the decree, and he goes in sackcloth and ashes to the streets. And Esther Amalka sends a message to Fasach, to Mordechai, to ask him what's the cause of his distress. And her words are, Mazeh ve'al Mazeh. She has two questions. I think the two questions can be understood on two levels. And these two levels apply to any phenomena in the world. On the one level, you have the psychological, the sociological, the economic, the military, the biological, the chemical, the physical, that which is nir einayim, that which, when the Gemara says, yesh chachm b'goyim tamein, the goyim can analyze this on the surface level, that's one level that's reality. That's mazeh. The al-mazeh, what does the Hashkocha Elokis want from this? What is the drisha that Hezbollah is putting in front of us on the basis of this phenomenon? Nothing happens by accident. Everything is an expression of Hashkocha. What's the pnimius of the phenomenon? She asks both questions. That means both are necessary to know. Of course, it's obvious. If you have only Mage, only the surface, only the Chachma of the Goyim, you're missing out on the essence of the phenomenon. The essence of the phenomenon is its Tzminius. It's Ruchnius, what it was Rorokha wants. Of a Mitzad Sheni, you can't get the Tzminius without understanding the Tzminius. That's why the Mazeh is important. Why is that? Because the Mazeh is the way in which a Kodesh Baruch Hu communicates the Pnimius. The surface of the phenomenon, the psychological, the sociological, the economic, the military, and the rest, are the details in which the Hashkocha Elokis expresses itself, and which is crucial to be able to understand what the Hashkocha Elokis is trying to get us to understand and how to respond. And therefore she asks Mazeh ve'al Mazeh. That's the key to understanding the whole Maaseh Purim. That's not our subject this morning. I want to look at anti-Semitism on both levels, the Mazeh level and the Al-Mazeh level. At least a couple of the aspects that we can explore. There is a book called Why the Jews, authored by two men, Prager and Telushkin. I mention the book because I think the book has a very useful examination of the Mazeh level, and I mention specifically the authors to tell you that, in my eyes, the authors do not have emun. They are not people who can be trusted to express a Torah point of view. In this book, they happen to have presented an important, I think, analysis of the superficial, the shitchi level, the level that's open to any Goyim principle. I'm going to mention their idea, because as I say, I think it's the superficial level, but I don't mention the book by way of giving a samchus to the authors. They document the fact that anti-Semitism is the oldest and most widespread human hatred. Its roots go back to at least the Greeks. You all know of blood libels. The idea of a blood libel was invented by the Greeks. Centuries before Christianity, there was a Greek calumny that before Pesach, Jews capture a Greek adult and hide him away and slaughter him as part of the Pesach Chag. So the Christians just took that over. They adopted it. And the record in ancient Egypt that indeed there was a Yetzias Mitzrayim. The reason for it was that Yidin Rachmana Lassan had Tzaraas, and they were communicating Tzaraas to the Egyptians, so the Egyptians threw them out. So the idea of treating the Jews as an object of critique, scorn, second class status, it didn't start with Christianity, they maybe took it over. Now, seeing that anti-Semitism is a widespread, the most widespread and consistent human hatred, it will be a mistake of logic to try to explain why, for example, Poles hated Jews in the 18th century on the basis of the local economic conditions, or the local geographical conditions, or on particular historical events. Because this is a consistent human phenomenon. To explain a consistent human phenomenon on the basis of the details, the unique details of a particular setting, is mistaken logic. What we need is a theme that explains consistently across the board, since it is a consistent human expression. Secondly, they document the relative strength of anti-Semitism. If you look at different societies, at different ideologies, and measure their opposition to Torah and to Jews, I've already given away the answer. You'll find a very interesting gradation in the strength of the hatred and the ferocity of the persecution. In the Far East, where you have isolated Jewish communities, in China and India, there's no anti-Semitism to speak of. Seems that not to have been recorded any anti-Semitic beliefs, feelings, expressions, or actions. In the ancient world, you have some critique. One Roman writer said that we are the laziest of all peoples. Take off one day a week. What we have given the world, the idea that you don't work your life till the end, the Romans thought that was just a sign of laziness. Among the Greeks, there were those who said that the Jews are godless. Because if you don't have a statue, and you don't have a physical form, if your god isn't a sun, or a dragon, or a human being, then you have no god. But these were sporadic, isolated, not consistent at all. And the amount of persecution was minimal. Then you jump to the Enlightenment period. The Enlightenment, well, they call them thinkers, describe us in very negative terms. Voltaire wrote a dictionary, philosophical dictionary. If I remember correctly, something like one third of all his entries deal with Jews. This is the new philosophy of mankind. It's preoccupied. He's hypnotized by the Jewish question. But aside from denigrating us, criticizing us as not being enlightened as they were, as they thought they were, there was very little open opposition. Then you come to Islam. In Islamic societies, we were second class citizens. The yellow star, the yellow badge, was invented by the Muslims. It was taken over by the Christians. But you don't find pogroms. Typically, you don't find pogroms. Sometimes you find quite reasonable respect for a second-class citizen. Then you come to the socialist and communist ideologies, where the opposition was much more brutal, much more open and focused. The Yevsektsia, which I'm sure you know, the special committee of the what was then called the NKVD, the secret police of the communist Russia, whose job it was to stamp out Judaism in particular. Rabbanim were sent to Siberia. And then beyond that you have Christian anti-Semitism, which I don't have to document for you. And finally you have the Nazi repetition of Haman's idea to oppose the very existence of the Jewish people in principle down to the last medal in the chapter of Moses. What is the reason, they ask, for this gradation of hatred, this gradation of opposition and persecution? Why is it weaker in some cases and stronger in others? And they say that this is an index of the strength of ideological conflict. To what extent does our existence and do our beliefs give the lie to the competing ideology? The greater extent to which they feel under pressure, contradicted, thwarted by our existence and by our ideology, to that extent they respond with hatred and with persecution. Let's take a look at the list. In the Far East, the few Jewish communities were so tiny, vis-a-vis vast populations, the population of India, the population of China. No matter what we believe, no matter what we practice, we didn't pose any threat to them. We were a minor, minor curiosity. And therefore, there was no reaction of hatred. The ancient world, the Torah stands opposed to the basic beliefs of the whole ancient world. One God, one creator, as against the whole pantheon of invented deities. Strict morality as against the rampant, gross immorality of the gods which they paid fealty to. The idea of one religion, which is reality, and the rest are fantasy. Whereas in the ancient world, every religion respected the correctness of every other religion. We stood in direct opposition to what they believed in. But again, we were a tiny minority. We were so out of step with what they believed that they treated us as an aberration, something which is, of course, destined to disappear. They didn't treat us as competition. Similar to the Enlightenment, although by the time of the Enlightenment, our survival, 1700 years in Gullus, Pella, that everyone recognizes a Pella, was something which they needed to be addressed and dealt with. But the thesis of the Enlightenment was, we will invest in education, and through education, all the old superstitions and religious beliefs will disappear. Naturally. It will happen naturally. Sure, we should identify the enemy, and we should castigate the enemy, but we don't have to take any active, practical actions to persecute, because it's going to die out in one or two generations as soon as we educate the population to understand that these are mere superstitions. Then you come to Islam. With Islam, you have a giant step in the level of threat that we pose to them, because Islam, like Christianity, pretend that they are based on our book, that they fulfill our book. They believe in Moshe Rabbeinu, they believe in Yetzias Mitzrayim, they believe in the Avos, they trace themselves back to our book. Now, we are the custodians of that book. They come into the world and say, we have a new prophet, and this prophet has taught us how to live out our destiny, which started with your book. It would be very useful for them if we would agree with him. And indeed, in the beginning of his career, Muhammad tried desperately to convince the Jews to support him. Only after decades of repeated rebuffs, repeated contradictions, did he give up and start to oppose us in an active form. Because we give him the lie. You say you're basing yourself on this book, well, the custodians of the book say you're lying. That's very difficult to stand. And therefore, we have to be, at best, second-class citizens, sometimes ghettoized, taxed specially. That's where the ideological conflict becomes more acute. When you come to the socialists and the communists, of course we give the lie to their ideology. All is economics, all people are identical and equal. Religion is just a superstition. But here you have an added factor. their ideology preaches violence. It preaches violence as inevitable and praiseworthy. Violence and lying. Fraud. Whole-scale fraud on whole populations in order to move your program forward. So we falsify their ideology, and their ideology is one of active, violent opposition, and that's why they start to persecute us in a systematic fashion. Christianity is even worse, because not only do we say that they are misrepresenting the Tanakh, our book, but we say they're guilty of Avodah Zarah. To say that a man is God is something which is rank of Avodah Zarah. So it's not only that we are in conflict over what the book means, but in the case of what the book says, they're all the Avodah Zarah. That's the most difficult, the most serious charge that can be leveled against them, and that's why they take it so seriously and have opposed us so consistently and so violently. The Nazis inherit the Christian prejudice. As one author who wrote a book on the Holocaust put in his in the front piece, he wrote, the Holocaust took place in the years 1939 to 1945 of the Christian era. That was exactly right. The Christian roots of Nazi anti-Semitism are open, are obvious. And indeed, it goes further than that, because the Nazis held that they're the chosen people, and there can't be two chosen peoples. And that's why, in particular, it was a conflict with us. So they wanted to rid the world of all non-Aryans. But the particular conflict was with us. So it's the strength of the ideological conflict that determines the extent to which they hate us and persecute us. That's the mantra, the surface. I think that's a very important and useful analysis. What is the Almaz? I want to share a few sources with you. As I said, I don't think this exhausts the subject, but it's the essence. If you look at Parshas Bilam, Parshas Balak, you'll see what did Moab and Midian want to accomplish vis-a-vis the Jewish people. It says, I'm telling you now, it's Hashem Mishmur. L'chono or ali etam azeh, ketsu mimeni uli urchal nakebo v'agarshenu min ha'oretz. Maybe I can strike him and chase him out of the land. This is not a matter of genocide. This is not a matter of subjugation, to conquer and to enslave. No, just agarshenu min ha'oretz. And when it's repeated over, when Bilam repeats it over, he says, I can just push him out. That's all he wanted, just to push us out. What was the threat to them if we come into Eretz Israel? Says the Shem Yishmuel, if we come into Eretz Israel, we're going to Makadish the Gashmi. That's the purpose of being in Eretz Israel, to take the whole full agricultural and economic life and the Makadish the Gashmi. And when the Yid is Makadish the Gashmi, it will rob the Goy from the pleasure of the Gashmi. He will not be able to enjoy the Gashmi. He will not be able to focus on the Gashmi the way that he wants. He wants it, no strings attached. And once there is representative of an Ashut, real mankind, who raises the Gashmi to the Ruchni, he will never be able to do that again. Their attitude was, stay in the Midbar. The Kodesh Baruch will give you Nisan in the Midbar. You'll live Me'alat Eva. You're in a space capsule. You're disconnected from our world. That's exactly where you belong. That's exactly where we want you. Don't bother our ability to be nehen, to enjoy the Gashmi, for its own sake. How did we get to this? The Derech Hashem traces the development of mankind to the point where you have this conflict between Yidden, Am Yisrael, and Lahavdil Goyim. Adam and Chava. Adam was Yisrael. Adam was Yisrael. The original Bria had nothing of what we call today the rest of mankind. It didn't exist. So it was only Yisrael. As a result of the Chait, says the Ramchal, as a result of the Chait, the entire universe took a giant step down. Our Gashmias was created as a result of the Chait. Didn't exist. Gan Eden was on an entirely different level. What for Gan Eden was their lowest level, what they would have called Gashmi, became our Ruchnis. That's the highest we can hope for. Their Ruchnis is out of sight entirely. Something inaccessible to us. And our Gashmi came into existence because of the Chait. That includes the Gashmis of the Adam. This is why death is a necessary feature of our world, because the goof, as we have it, can't be mit'aleh, can't be elevated and sanctified by our mitzvot. Adam could have done that for his goof. Our goof can't take it. Therefore, it has to die and be and disintegrate and be reconstituted in Tchias HaMeisim in a form similar to that of Adam, which can then be elevated by the Meisim and Tovim that we do now. But it can't happen in one stage as it once was supposed to happen. Everything descended, everything was degraded, including Adam. Adam took on a new form, a form of the post-Eden world, the degraded world. But you can't climb back to the old ideal Metzius if you have no connection to it. There has to be something left of the connection, even if it's a minority. With that connection, the rest can be lifted up. So Kadosh Baruch Hu made it the possibility of connecting available, and available equally. From Adam to the Mabul, there was no Am, Nivchar, no special people, no two-class strata in human society. There were just people with opportunities. It's a gigantic failure. After the Mabul, again, says the Ramchal, through that whole period, anyone could have done what Abraham did. He could have been a shoresh for an Am that would have a relationship to that higher reality. Anyone and everyone could have done it. Only Abraham did it. Come to Matan Torah, you know what the Medrash says. That Kadosh Baruch Hu offered the Torah to all the peoples of the world, not in place of us, but in addition to us. There was no Havamina that we wouldn't get it. But there was a Havamina that others could have joined us. Everyone in the world could have joined us. Kadosh Baruch Hu is trying to reach all of mankind equally. But when finally, after being rebuffed time after time, Kadosh Baruch Hu said, I need a permanent representative in the world, that's going to be Klal Yisrael. The door is still open. Anyone who wants to convert can convert. The door is still open for everyone. In principle, everyone can convert. Hadassah say, Sinai, you're the sin of Olam. Because now, the matzav into which an Anjou was born is a matzav of two strata. There's one strata of mankind that represents the original of Adam and represents a relationship with Gan Eden and a way of living in this world to be connected to Gan Eden. And an Adam that represents the expulsion from Gan Eden, the result of the Chait in Gan Eden. And that Chait means an attachment to Gashmias for its own sake. Versus the attachment to Gan Eden, which means elevating the Gashmi and making it Ruchni. That's the shorish of the difference between the two groups. And Kadosh Baruch Hu wants to be Or LaGoyim, as Yeshaya says, to try to have this penetrate their lives. Now the truth is, they are profoundly equivocal about this. Because on the one hand, they're attached to the Gashmi, and they want it, and on the other hand, they sense that something else exists and is higher. I had a Talmud in Ur-Samer 10, 12 years ago who said something absolutely brilliant. Haman comes out from the first party and he has everything. And he wrote Bonov and Osher and fame, and he's second in command of the entire kingdom. And he sees Mordechai, Osher B'Shar HaMelech, but he says, B'chol Zeh Einenu Shoveli. This is all worthless to me. Worthless. Maybe it bothers you that he's sitting there. Maybe it's a fly in the ointment, but worthless with all that you have? So this Talmud said, yes, when the goy sees that the Jew sits in the Shaar HaMelech, and you know that in the Megillah it says HaMelech without HaKasheros, it means the Kodesh Baruch Hu also. And he says, all my Gashmias is nothing because it's a shell for Ruchnias. And the Jew has the Ruchnias, and I don't have that. Chazal say that would the Goyim know what the Beis HaMikdash does for them, they would surround it with legions of soldiers to protect it from all harm. What does the Beis HaMikdash do for them? It gives them some connection to the Ruchni. Some connection to the Ruchni. They too have a Neshama. That Neshama cries out for the Ruchni. But the Ruchni means a different attitude towards the Gashmi. So they suffer this deep, deep conflict. And they resolve the conflict often by simply turning their backs on the Ruchni, which means turning their backs on us. What we have to learn from this is that the ideological conflict, which is the Mazeh, is a mask for a much deeper conflict. The deeper conflict is, how do you deal with the Olam HaGashmi? Do you dedicate it to Ruchnius, or do you take it on its own? Hazal say, Lo Avdu Yisrael Avodah Zarah El Hatil Lehem Arayah Sefarasi. Even for us, the ideology of Avodah Zarah was a cover-up for a descent into Gashmi. So what we need to know is, when we look at the ideological conflict, and on the surface, their hatred of us is measured by the extent of ideological conflict, that's only the surface. Deeper down, it's a matter of the way in which Gashmias is used, and if we use it correctly, then we will affect them. We will push their conflict to the correct resolution, where instead of dedicating themselves to the Gashmi and turning their backs on the Ruchni, they too will be elevated by the Ruchni, if we do it correctly. We did it once correctly. You made David HaMelech, Shlomo HaMelech. What happened? The kings of the world saw that the Torah is something extraordinary, Eloki, and they came to learn. Why? Because we had a kingdom, we had a country, we had a society that was able to elevate the Gashmi, and they saw that, and that was mashpia on them to resolve the conflict in a positive way and to come to learn from us. That's what we're here for. If we don't do it that way, then Rachmana L'Shlam, we have to do it by being in Golus. And by being in Golus, we too have an effect. We too have an effect. There are historians who write that if you look at medieval Europe, the only place in medieval Europe where you could find something that we today would regard as civilized was in the Jewish ghetto. The rest of the world was wild, savage, brutal, inhuman. And we, in our little pockets, in our little protected populations, we preserved something elevated, and that was mashpia on the whole of Europe, to develop the level of civilization, sorely lacking as it is, but the level of civilization which they have achieved, and will continue to mashpia that they should be elevated. That's our job, whether we're in Eretz Yisrael with a Malchus, or whether we're scattered throughout the world. We have to know that anti-Semitism, at root, is an index of our relationship to them, and it's our job to act in such a way that we can elevate them. In the times of David and Shlomo, there was no anti-Semitism. On the contrary, they held us to be the spitz, the spitz of mankind. It's our job to elevate the Gashmi and make it Ruchni, and if we do that successfully, then anti-Semitism will collapse, and they will understand that we are the key to the Ruchnis of the world. Thank you very much.